Hello, this is just a short note to say that this episode was recorded on December 30th, 2024. We hope to continue with conversations soon, and you can expect part two to follow. Hello, 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 and welcome to the 2024 edition of our favorite films of the year. We will be discussing around 10 films each today. I'm Eliana, and I'm joined by Patrick.
Hello.
And hello, Lawrence Garcia.
Hello.
And Oiku Sofuolu.
Hello.
So,
I was thinking I want to confront you with this statement, and you can say if you agree or not. Let's be very controversial. 2024 was a bad year in movies. Do you agree with that overall assessment?
I don't agree with it at all. I think it was a really good year, at least for me personally. I won't be able to like make any statements about the film industry, but like for me this year had lots of films that touched me on a personal level, which wasn't the case in last year. Like, there were films that were objectively good, but I didn't feel as engaged as I am today with the films I put to my list. Like, there are more films that I will remember from this year. I think that's what it counts the most. But this is a really personal thing. So, I don't know. But for me, it was a good year.
That's an awesome answer, I think, because if you feel really engaged with them and if you have a personal connection to them, I think, yeah, those will accompany you for a long time. How about you, Lawrence?
I think this year, well, I'll preface this by saying that I saw fewer films, I think, this year than I did last year, just because I didn't do like the festival circuit, like Berlin, Cannes. I didn't do, so I only did TIFF this year. But overall, I wouldn't really say that, at least in comparison to last year, that it was much weaker or much stronger. Like, maybe other people felt that last year was much stronger and in comparison that this year is weaker, but I think they're pretty on par. And in some ways, I thought 2024 had some higher highlights, at least for me, than even last year. So I would say I would agree with Oiku in that, maybe for different reasons, that I think it was still a solid year.
And how about you, Patrick?
Yeah, for me, it was just I felt overall more disappointments throughout. And I thought these festivals that in some respect are, you know, more of the highlights of the year, like Cannes and Berlin, I vividly remember that in 2023, I had some films that I thought, oh yeah, those films will accompany me for years. And there will be films I look back to more that I didn't feel so strongly this year. You know, last year I felt like, oh, the new Teddy Williams, the new Radu Jude, the new Nuri Bilge Ceylan, and I could go on and go on. And I didn't feel like there were many films of that sort of caliber this year. However, I will say that this year I think one of the aims or goals I set for 2024 was to attend more festivals of maybe, you know, a smaller register, just to see what festival circuit overall could look like. And I think in this, I took much more pleasure, and perhaps also I found that much more gratifying to see smaller film festivals. I went to Yerevan in Armenia, for instance, and I went to Rotterdam. And I think those kind of festivals are perhaps in some respect more aligned with my overall outlook on how film festivals could be. You know, they feel more intimate. You make much more easily connections with other people. It feels, yeah, it just feels more like a communal experience. And this, of course, doesn't seem to be related to the films, but you actually make a lot of, yeah, you find films that wouldn't have been on your radar at all. So there are also some festivals that I just noticed that I would want to attend in the future, like Vision du Réel, for instance, that I think, oh, they actually have a lot of films every year that seem more daring than at other film festivals. So of course, I, you know, just put this up for a conversation, this thesis, and I still think that especially if one widens one's scope of what films or what festivals are actually part of your consideration, then there will never be a bad film here. There are just too many films, you know, that come out each year. And only because films are not necessarily on your radar, that doesn't mean that the film year overall was bad. So, yeah, there's a big caveat to my initial statement. How about you, Aliana?
I'd say I feel this year I've suffered from cinema amnesia and cinema ignorance to a degree, and being between forgetting, well, obviously forgetting, and just not being so motivated or interested in going to the theater to see some things. Of course, there's the issue of availability, and the fact that we are talking about films that are technically released, perhaps, or have their world premiere in one country or through one festival, but ultimately don't even make it to the theaters until the fall, the subsequent year, or even a year or two or three after, which not might not be the greatest for discussing films that people who might be listening have not yet seen. I do agree also with Oiku overall that in the end, the films that I've put on my list are films that have touched me or intrigued me in a way that I haven't quite seen before. But at the same time, too, the film titles that you mentioned, Patrick, of last year, still Jaylan's film is very big for me, or even La Bête, which I got to see this year at Rotterdam. And it was also very interesting. We got to go to TIFF for the first time as well. I, through the Media Inclusion Initiative, saw Lawrence there, and Armenia, where Oiku was as well. And I was also in Zagreb for a workshop, and, well, not including TIFF, but these smaller festivals were at a different level of engaging with cinema and their locale. The Armenian Film Festival was drenched in so much emotional and political reactions to the films that were being shown, especially during the due to the fact that Armenia is technically at war right now with a region.
Yeah, there were a lot of films about that region as well, right? I forgot how to say it in English, like Karabakh, you know, this region with and this conflict with Azerbaijan. Yeah, it's really, I mean, it may sound crude to say it in that way, but it's really interesting to see how this, you know, affects a film festival and how it reacts to it, and then to see the people at the place there engage with it. Yeah, I just wanted to quickly throw in two or three other things and see if you have any reaction to it. If not, that's also fine. It's just some observations I randomly made this year. For instance, for some reason, 2024 was the year of war photography. We had this Alex Garland film, Civil War. We had this film Lee with Kate Winslet. We had this Sundance documentary, Never Look Away, by Lucy Lawless, devoted to this journalist. I forgot her name right now, I'm sorry. And there is The Room Next Door, which had this weird, you know, plot line with Tilda Swinton, where we go back in time to her time as a war journalist. Just, I wonder if that, you know, overall is also a reaction to our political landscape, that this is embedded into these narratives. Then The Intermission is back, and I'm sort of welcoming it. You know, we had, of course, majorly it was featured in The Brutalist, but we also had it in a film that some of us appreciated, I think, Direct Action, and a film that is more of a, you know, on a very small, it's not known by many people, castration movie from Canada that will show up later in my list. And yeah, so Intermission, I really like Intermissions. I think it's, you know, it's closest we can get to how the act of reading can feel like. You know, we are given some time, we can reread lines, we can reflect on what we are reading, what we are taking in. So I would actually like it if more films had intermissions. And 2024 was the attempt of the great American movie. I really want to focus on the attempt, you know, but we had these megalomaniac attempts with Megalopolis, Francis Ford Coppola's new film. We had the Horizon Project that we don't know if it will ever be completed. And we have The Brutalist, which, you know, one can have very different opinions on. But yeah, anything of that sparking some response from your side?
I'd say I was just like thinking simultaneously while you're speaking about war photography. I was wondering if it's like a reaction to the way like this artificial images are completely invading our visual space, so that now we're trying to turn back to the authenticity, to the veracity of the image, to claim it back. Maybe it's a reaction to that, this need, this urge to find the truth about war, about humanity. And since war photography in the past is a form of capturing that, or at least like questioning that, and it's a safer place maybe than the virtual cyberspace, and how the images are circulated and represented in our in that cyberspace, I think it's like a counter reaction or like a refuge to go back there and look back at the truth again. And regarding intermission, I mean, of course, the films are made with intermission, but like as someone coming from Turkey, in my own viewing experiences, intermissions were always part of that. When you go to theater in Turkey, there are still intermissions, even though the films themselves don't have it.
Oh, that's interesting.
So that's really interesting. I think even when the film is not intended to be like a separated into two, I like grew up with that like 15 minutes break, and it's interesting now that it's also a traditional thing in cinema, but yeah, so it's also like really subjective, I would say. And great American film, it's huge, obviously, but I was maybe wondering that since it's American Horizon is intended to be like a chapters of films, maybe it's also connected to the how cinema is becoming like a serial thing to like a chronicle, and it's like a not cinema itself, but like a form of turning a weird mixture between TV series with chapters and sequels. And maybe that's also part of like this. I was thinking of this weird Taylor Sheridan series in like Yellowstone and 1923, like these kind of series that also try to like depict American West, I guess. And maybe that's also a reaction to claim back the cinema scape with those narratives. But I don't know. I just, these are just like things that came up to my head.
Yeah, I mean, I think in relation to the war journalism question, I guess it didn't really leap out to me, in part because I haven't seen a lot of the movies that you mentioned. Like, I didn't see Civil War. I did see the Room Next Door.
Neither did I, by the way.
I mean, given his other movies, you might avoid. But I think what Oiku said is probably right. I think there is some impulse to turn back to that kind of the authenticity of the image in some sense, though. I think even in like the present day, like I think there is still, like, even though like theoretically people may have some sort of skepticism about images, like I think a film like No Other Land, I mean, it's like a demonstration that like there is still a kind of, like, I don't think we are that actually skeptical of the capacity to record and document, like, you know, atrocities or events, right? Like, I think pragmatically, like, we still see and understand the kind of force that those images kind of have. Yeah, so I mean, it would be interesting to sort of see these sort of fictionalized like war photography contexts in contrast to like all the documentaries, I guess, about different sort of parts of the world and different things going on, as like, and it's less, I mean, it's weird to call that a trend, but I think it would be interesting to think about that alongside like the kind of fictionalized versions, especially Hollywood versions that we see. In terms of intermissions, I don't really have any thoughts, except that, I mean, it's a sign that like the movie is extremely long, and I think I appreciate the intermission if only for that, but I don't know about this trend towards length necessarily. Like, I think in The Brutalist especially, I find that the length isn't really doing much except like telegraphing grandeur. In the case of Direct Action, I think the duration serves a different purpose, which we could probably get into later, but I think sometimes the intermission is just like, it does become kind of more of a statement rather than an interesting part of the actual movie, but your mileage may vary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel too on these 3 points. It's or these 2 points rather, the Great American Film and War Journalism, that what you two discuss are just this. There's still this modern idea that a war correspondent, a war journalist, is perhaps a form of a hero, even though we know that there is the possible corruption of actual fact that can also be carried within their own job. But this, and for the American, Great American Film, I think people do want, ultimately, out of all this mess that is the world, that is life, to find or to attach themselves to ideas that seem to have meaning and grandiose. And I didn't think we'd be talking about The Brutalist for today, period. this is a consequence of such thoughts.
Okay, and as a heads up, I send you these questions of, I asked you to comment to these categories of movies I did not get, movies they did not get, and scene of the year. So if you have something like that, so movies I did not get, I think it's self-explanatory. So films that were acclaimed to some degree, but you didn't, sense deep affinities with, if there's something that comes to mind that would be interesting to me. How about you, Erku?
April, definitely April. Like, that cinema is not for me, but I understand why people are like praising it, enjoying it with this transcendental quality. But I think it's the art house 2000s Haneke aesthetics didn't work for me at all, and everything written about that film sounds fake to me. Like, I don't engage with the writing either. It's just a big no for me, and I don't even want to talk about that film. Like, it's yeah, I think April was the biggest one among them.
Okay, any film that comes to mind for you, Lawrence?
I think for me, I have two, and I know they'll come up later, but the first is Payal Kapadia's All We Imagine Is Light. Like, that movie, I understand to some degree why people like it, but it also seems like a very safe, almost kind of like very timid movie in some sense, that it kind of wants to avoid like big swings. I won't say more, but the other movie that I think about is actually Caught by the Tides, which I also know will probably come up later. I quite like Jiajanka's like early movies, but I feel like recently, especially, I have found it more of a struggle to appreciate what he's doing. And while I like conceptually, I think, what he's doing here, I don't know, I found myself really struggling to see value in it, other than a kind of retrospective look, which I feel like a lot of his recent stuff has already been doing. I'll keep it there, because we will talk about these movies later.
Right.
I also didn't mention like films like The Substance or Emilia Perez, because I don't think they deserve to be talked here.
Yeah. That's all right. Let's just, pretend that you didn't say that right now. And Eliana?
I would say the film that we mentioned earlier, and Juror Number 2. I didn't really feel that film much while watching it. And I've had outside entertainment value that almost seemed so, I can't believe this is being made, that it became funny to a degree. And that got me through the screening. And this will not come up, but Anora was also very interesting, but I don't think that I didn't get it, but I'm glad. But we've already talked about this in another episode, just fighting with the cinema of Sean Baker and this current film.
Okay, and for me, it's I saw The TV Glow by Jane Schoenbrunn. I really like the subject of the film itself, but I don't like if it's just, you know, if it's just imposed on me so obviously that I don't think I actually get to engage with it, because it's, you know, it's all so explicit, and it's all so, you know, I feel like the film doesn't leave me any room to think about it, because it's all so clearly expressed. It's a bit like the zone of interest, where I think, oh, I see the idea, and now we just go through with it. The Brutalist is another film like that, that I feel like, oh, it really wants to be that, but I don't feel it at all. So yeah, films they did not get. Films that you feel strongly about, but other people didn't seem to have the same response. For me, that was a bit difficult. Because I feel like basically I could bring forth my entire top 10, and to some degree, that is more or less the case. But I would just pick this very small film I saw at Rotterdam. It's called SR, SR by Lea Hartlaub. It's a small essay film about the giraffe and the many meanings and significances it has assumed throughout history. And it's the sort of ongoing thought about our relation to this specific animal and what it has come to represent, even leading to our colonialist past in Germany or the conflict in Israel and Palestine. So yeah, a very interesting film, but I think it hasn't landed anywhere. You know, it hardly traveled elsewhere apart from Rotterdam. So I felt a bit sad about that. But yeah, that's my film.
Yeah, just to piggyback off of you, because we didn't actually talk about that beforehand, but I also would choose SR. I've heard so many people tell me, why did you like this film? Or even actively going out of their way to say that they quite disliked it.
And how about you, Erki?
I would be more conventional about this, but I'd say The Shroud. Like, obviously there will be a lot of people who also praise the film, but I think people like tend to say that it's a bad film, like just properly bad film, which I don't think it is. That there are so many interesting points that kept like working with me even after I saw it the first time, and I'm really looking forward to see it again. There's still things that are going on that I'm trying to like understand, and I enjoy films that give me that feeling. Like, I think that this was with what happened with The Beast last year, so I'm curious. And yeah, but like people tend to say that it's just a bad film, but they're especially about that of death, of losing someone. There are so many ambiguous points that I want to go back and see again. Yeah, I think there's something there. It's hard to talk about that film.
And you, Lawrence?
I guess I didn't actually pick anything that wasn't... the films that I thought about were also on my list, but I guess this is like almost a kind of preview then, because I think the would be my number 10... Steven Soderbergh's Presence, which I think some of you saw. It was at Sundance. Mm-hmm. It's coming out in January. And I think it's pretty easy to dismiss as quite a bad film. And I know I have a friend who thought it was like the worst thing he saw at TIFF. But I actually think it's in some ways more complex than it looks. And like, I think the hook is immediately appealing to me, but I think it's almost being undersold by the fact that it's... people take what Soderbergh says about it for granted, that the fact that it's supposed to be a film shot entirely from the POV of a ghost in a house, that's the gimmick of the film. But I actually think like it's not so clear that you can really just claim that. about the film, and it becomes a more interesting film if you think about the tension between that claim and what you actually see. And I think that's being undersold, I think, in the way people engage with this film.
That's interesting. I would like to read something about that, because I feel like I initially was more on the side of your friend there, but I think there can be something said more substantially about that filmmaking choice. In any case, we have to go on here. Scene of the year, I will make that quick. There are many, many scenes. I would just pick one that sticks out because it's a film I won't mention again, I think. And that's the opening scene of an unfinished film by Lu Ye, when there is this old Mac Pro, you know, this tower that, you know, seems to be stemming from a different era. And they go back at the beginning of the film. It's a bit like in the Victor Erice film, to unearth and this film that was never finished. And then they start the computer, and they first have to make sure that they can actually play the film because the technology is not as compatible as it used to. Then they have to try to sync the sound and everything, just all to get back to that time, you know. And we see all the interfaces from back then. It's all something that we so easily forget in how technology evolves. And I think that there was such a fascinating, yeah, unearthing of a different time in artists' work, but also in technology. And I think that came together well. How about you, Eliana?
I would say that it's just a very small moment, but one that gave me quite a lot of delight in Alma Tovar's The Room Next Door. But when one of the characters, well, I'll just speak vaguely, one of the characters realizes that, in fact, the other thinks that she is dead, and then appears behind, and there's the slightest smile of just recognition of this friend's concern or sadness. But we will talk about, I'll talk about that a little bit more, because somehow The Room Next Door has made my top 10 for the friendship and the themes that perhaps I would like to think go beyond just the simple viewing, maybe more in line with how you feel about presence, but from an emotional sense.
Okay, great. And you, Aiku?
This will be really cliche, but the dinner scene where they talk about what they want to become in their lives and by the stream, that scene touched me a lot because I watched that film on my birthday, and it's such a emotionally powerful scene about confessions, about hopes, about oneself. Yeah, I mean, it's a really personal thing that I don't think I can explain right now, but I would say that scene.
Okay, awesome. And now, before we...
You didn't ask Lawrence.
Oh, sorry, Lawrence, of course.
For me, I mean, there were a couple of scenes that I thought about. One was, I mean, this is a bit cliche, but there was the scene in Furiosa with the Warwick introduction. But I think the one that I want to highlight is the one that will maybe come up later, but it's the scene in Direct Action before the intermission where we have the drone shot. And so that, oh, yeah, that sequence, I think, was a big highlight for me in a film that ultimately I have some reservations about. But that scene, just the way that it broke from the sort of formal constraints of the previous however many minutes and entered this sort of like aerial space right before the intermission, I thought that was just superbly done, superbly placed. You kind of wonder why drone shots don't always look this amazing. But yeah, so that scene would be my scene of the year, probably.
Oh, that's a great pick. Yeah, I really like that too. And I want to preamble that two films I did not see, so they couldn't possibly be on my list. Nickel Boys by Ramel Ross, a film really difficult to see in Europe because it wasn't playing anywhere really. I think maybe in London, I don't know. And Afternoons of Solitude by Albert Serra, yeah, that played in Spain at the film festival, but apart from that, was also difficult to see. But I would be really interested in that. And yeah, honorable mentions, so films that did not make our list, I would just rush through them. All We Imagine Is Light by Paya Kapadia, Caught by the Tides by Jiajanke, Sleep With Your Eyes Open by Nele Volatz from Berlin, SR, I mentioned that earlier, by Lea Hadlow, Chirrup, that was a small, obscure film from Canada by Devon Shears, Sad Jokes by Fabian Stumm. He's like one of an upcoming filmmaker from Germany that has only produced two films so far, but I liked both of them very much. Familiar Touch by Sarah Friedland. That film played at Venice and was one of the strongest ones there, I think. A Different Man by Aaron Schimberg. Good One by India Donaldson, certainly also a contender for Scene of the Year, I think. Anora by Sean Baker. The more I thought about it, the more I, you know, some reservations grew in me, but I still think the filmmaking there is superb, so I am a bit conflicted there. Baby Girl by Halina Rain, an unfinished film by Lu Ye, Pepe by Nelson Carlos de los Santos Arias, Matt and Mara, another Canadian film by Kazid Radwanski, Une Langue Universelle by Matthew Rankin, Lazaro at Night by Nicolas Pereira, Desert of Namibia from Japan, and Dahomey by Mati Diop. Any films you would like to highlight before we finally delve into our top 10s?
I'd say No Sleep Till by Alexander Simpson, that also played in Venice. And a film that I discovered in this year in Belfort was a really surprising discovery for me. It's called Soft Shell. I don't think it played in major film festivals anywhere. And it's by an American filmmaker named Gino Myung. I strongly recommend those two films. They're really good.
Awesome. Eliana?
I would say that there were a lot of films that you already mentioned. I also quite liked 78 Days, a Serbian film by Emilija Gašić. And this one was interesting as well, Inkwash, which we saw at TIFF by Sara Tsourakidis, I believe, of Greek, perhaps, origin, but I'm not sure whether the director...
Yeah, I think so.
That's all I'll say for now, yeah.
Okay, and for you, Lawrence?
Yeah, so I have nothing so obscure. There's one, so Lazaro at Night, you mentioned already, by Nicolas Pereira. I would have Hong Sang-soo's Traveler's Needs on my honorable mentions as well. And I guess also just because short films often fall out of the conversation, I'll mention two that I quite liked at Wavelengths this year at TIFF. So Revolving Rounds by Johan Lerf. And the other one is Diary of a Sky by Lawrence Abu Hamdan. It's probably hard to see, especially the first one, because it's in 3D. But if you ever get a chance, those two are quite strong from this year. And arguably, if I was thinking of including shorts in my top 10, which I probably should have, they would be there.
Awesome, yeah. It's. I think there's conversations to be had about short films and how cinema could try to advocate more for them and try to bring forth some screenings, maybe sometimes mix them thematically or formally or something, so they can actually be seen more, you know. In the past, that was more the case in cinema, I feel like. But today, it's almost like exclusively a festival-related thing. But anyway, that's our moment now, finally. Let's come to the top 10, because we're already quite advanced in our conversations. And yeah, I will just be free and delve directly to my top 10 movie, which is Misericorde by Alain Giraudy. And I know this film will show up later, so I will just leave it at that. Oku, what is your number 10?
I have The Periphery of the Bays. We have it also in our list, I guess.
Yeah.
Like in the... Okay.
It's so going to come up later, so...
Then...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, great. And Eliana?
I guess my top 10 is The Room Next Door by Almodovar. Pedro Almodovar. And, well, what to say? I've heard a lot of people say that they found this film was rather stiff. It's kind of missing Almodovar's charm of Spanish. But for me, after 30 minutes into the film or so, even though I do think the plot points are contrived, we have Ingrid and Martha, played by Julianne Moore and Tilda Swinton, who meet after decades of being apart, even though it's known that they used to be friends. Swinton's character used to be a war correspondent, and Moore's character is a successful novelist who seems to write self-help books on the topic of death. And Swinton's character is also suffering from cancer and asks Moore's character to be with her in the room next door because she's decided that she'd like to end her life. And when the door to the room is closed, Moore's character will know that the death has occurred, that Swinton has decided to take the pill that she has gotten from some black market or...
And first forgets, and then she has to go back to New York. Yeah.
Yes, yes. The film touched me primarily for emotional reasons, just friendship, female friendship, this idea too, which could and is political, of the right to euthanasia. And I know it's not necessarily new in films or anything, but somehow throughout the course of the film, even though it didn't feel or wasn't shot this way, it felt as if close-ups carried the film towards the end for me. And I found it strangely very touching and very sweet, and a story that I haven't quite necessarily seen. I believe it is also inspired or based on a novel by Sigrid Nunes, which I cannot remember the name of right now. There's a lot of room for levity in comedy, as I mentioned earlier in one of the so-called scenes of the year. But wondering how your reception of it was.
That was also really hard for me to, like, not to put in my top 10. Like, it's I think it's a really, really strong film from this year. And I think it's a late period Almodovar, in a sense that you clearly see what he wants to do, his intentions, his references are there, his color palette. So even though people think that when he's like working with English language, it feels fake, I thought that the way Tilda Swinton's character talks is a way of mirroring the way she feels about life, like this burst of monologue, like she wants so much to talk about her distress, her agony, but her also wish to live, her hunger for life, that it kind of bursts into her speaking habits. That really touched me, and The Dead by John Huston and also by James Joyce are works that I personally admire a lot. So there were so many things that touch me on a personal level, but with a really exquisite cinematic touch to add references to a film. But as you said, on an emotional level, I think illness, death, and how to live with them, how to deal with them, are matters that I usually think about, and how one can deal with those subjects and creatively, but also through friendship, was really interesting for me as well.
Even though it's not very subtle, I think the message there is very important, and it was interesting. I think we saw some friends afterwards, and Patrick expressed that he didn't like the film, and this friend just simply said, "Oh, it's because you're not as close to death." And this was such an eerie thing to sort of say, I think, as well. But...
And I kept thinking The Room Next Door in parallel bit with Familiar Touch, even though those have different styles, aesthetics. But I think the representation of care and love while someone is suffering or while you're losing someone is a common thread between those two films, at least for me.
Yeah, I think we have to contain this because we have to go on. But yeah,
let's move on.
Just very quickly, Öykü, you said that one can see Almodovar's intentions clearly in this. And I think that's where I take issue with, you know, that I see the intention so clearly that I feel sort of taken aback. And that's why I couldn't, you know, connect more strongly with the film. But yeah, let's go on. Do we have another top 10?
Yeah, so my number 10 is a movie that I mentioned already. So Steven Soderbergh's Presence. I mean,
oh,
if you haven't heard about the movie, it's just, it's basically the gimmick, if you want to call it that, is that the entire movie is shot from the POV or the point of view of a ghost living, who's supposed to be living in this house. And there's a family who moves in and there are sort of strange occurrences that happen. And I think that's a reasonable way of describing the film. That's how the screenwriter and how Soderbergh himself has described the film. But I think what I find interesting about it is the way that the film itself, by this conceit of having an invisible camera, essentially, like an invisible entity be in the place of the camera, how that plays with our sort of sense of genre expectation. The way I put it in a review is, well, is the camera there because something is going to happen, or is something going to happen because the camera is there, right? Because in genre, we sort of have this expectations of things that will happen simply because the camera is there. If the camera is there, we know, okay, something important is going to happen. Otherwise, we wouldn't be seeing this. We would be seeing something else, right? And I think the way that the film plays with that by having the ghost supposedly be in the exactly the camera's position is quite interesting. And I think people who just take the film fully as having the camera be the ghost is sort of ignores this sort of tension that creates with the genre expectation. So that's what I would say about the film and how I would make sort of a case for it.
Yeah, and I don't know who else has seen the film actually here. Oku hasn't, and Eliana, you saw only chunks of it.
It was a silly thing. Essentially, I was led into the theater 20 minutes into the film, and then I was at this angle, and I went, oh gosh. Yeah. But the angle of the camera, which plays such a large role, was very nauseating. Mm-hmm. And I excused myself, but I need to perhaps with this difference revisited.
That's fair.
I was just thought. Yeah.
Oh yeah, sorry, go on.
No, I was just gonna say that for Room Next Door I was at a very poor camera angle, so Tilda Swinton's face was very large and very distorted while I was watching that movie, which maybe is why I didn't respond that strongly. Anyway, Patrick.
No, just I find that very interesting what you're saying, and I that just reminds me that I should probably read your writing on it, so I could perhaps make more sense of the, you know, of the form of the film, because I thought like there is something to that film, but at the time I wasn't quite getting at it, you know. I was thinking more like, oh, this, and I mean, maybe it was from a filmmaker's perspective, but what do I care about that, right? But so to me it seemed more like a gimmick, and but maybe there is some point to elucidate here, so I just want to maybe revisit that through your writing, maybe. Yeah. So let's move on to number 9. Eliana, what's your number 9?
Number 9, I seem to have put Israel Palestine on Swedish TV.
And that's fantastic because that's also my number 9.
Ah, okay. So would you like to talk about it?
I'll just say the full title, right?
Yes.
Between Israel Palestine on Swedish TV 1958 to 1989 by Göran Olsson, a Swedish director. Eliana, what did you like about that?
So between these years, or as public Swedish TV does aim towards being impartial, and or they call it non-partial, actually, I think, and to report. This goes a little bit into what we were talking about of the, I guess, our ideal war correspondent or war journalist idea, or the idea of truth. And the director seemed to have gone into the archives and found what was presented at one point on specifically Swedish TV following the inception of the country, Israel, to just after the Berlin Wall falls, I suppose, or is it before, or
yeah,
89 is also the election.
Yeah, and the film ends basically in 1993 with Oslo, you know, with the accord there. You know, there's this little epilogue in the end when they think, oh, now the future looks bright. But of course, we know better, and we know that the future, unfortunately, doesn't look bright at all.
I think it was more thematically, which seems to be an unavoidable, trying to position something, looking towards the past to sort of see issues with the present. There were there's a scene where the Palestinian newspaper are actively trying to put together the next morning edition, but everything is redacted because they're not even allowed to say certain names or certain words due to the censorship. But I think I will have a bit of a difficulty discussing this period.
Maybe I can jump in and just say, because those are my number nine, right? The film is so fascinating in, you know, to me, I don't want to take away from other films' merits, but to me, this is, you know, when everyone was talking about No Other Land, I think this film, I wish it were more central to the conversation as well, because it has this meta look at the overall coverage of how this conflict is framed. And we see through these images of public reporting of, you know, what claims to be impartial and in Sweden, how it shifts over the decades, how, for instance, in the first years, you know, when there are more and more settlements in Palestine of Israelis and so on, it is very much, you know, in favor of that, and it grows more and more distant toward that initial stance. And you can see how the coverage evolves over time, how also the violence disappears, you know, and this is something we don't have to just take as a comment on this conflict, but overall how our news has evolved, that violence is basically, you know, disappearing as if it doesn't, you know, exist anymore. We know, of course, that there are many ongoing conflicts at the moment. We know about, I mean, we know little, but we know that there is something in Sudan we don't really want to go into because it's all too upsetting and so on. But there's so much violence going on every day, but it has disappeared. But this film is such a profound reminder that there was a time when violence was imposed onto the reader or the viewer. And today we don't have to deal with that anymore. So in that sense, it's very interesting. It's interesting how public media changes its stance over the decades. And it's also, of course, we have tremendous footage of that time because Sweden had one of the most privileged position in the reporting because they had war correspondents throughout the decades there at every time. That means you have, you know, 16 millimeter footage that, by the way, and it's very distasteful of me to say, but it looks tremendous as well. So there's this weird thing even going on in my head that it looks so beautiful while you know, showing some very upsetting things. We actually see, you know, corpses and so on in the beginning as well. But as I said, they disappear over time. And it just, there are so many aspects to that. And the director, Olsen, he seems to be such an interesting figure. He made these two films concerning violence in 2014 that was basically working on Frantz Fanon's famous text, The Wretch of the Earth. And then he made this film on the civil rights movement, the Black Power mixtape, 1967 to 1975. So we see this sort of pattern is something that we can trace in his filmography. And one last thing I want to say, he's one of these people who say, I actually don't need to shoot material anymore because the archives are so rich. I much rather want to explore what we have actually recorded. And I mean, if you see this film, this material he has found in the archives that was just lying around, you know, basically, and he fully committed to exploring what was already there. And I think that's such an interesting concept, that to make a film, you don't need necessarily to shoot because there is so much at our disposal. Yeah. Okay. One very last thing. You can also see the transformation from media itself. So it starts with 16 millimeter black and white footage, and it goes on to, I think, VHS later in color, you know, like a very interesting concept overall, just to take that time frame and explore. Yep. So great film.
Yeah, I find it quite interesting, these films that use an, take a more archival approach, like Loznitsa is another, Sergei Loznitsa is another one who like has taken that sort of approach in his archival documentaries. Like when you talked about how it was almost weird how beautiful the imagery of this like horrific thing was going on, I thought of The Natural History of Destruction, which is his 2020, yep. I forget what year it was, but it does something similar with all this like World War II aerial bombing footage where it's beautiful, but it's obviously horrifying and terrifying. But yeah.
Maybe I can jump in a bit about Israel and Palestine, because I also had the chance to interview the director in Venice. And I think it's also like an similar to soundtrack for a coup d'etat, the way how there's a clear intention of mentioning, highlighting the sources, the importance of the source material, where they come from, because we have these recurrent screen inserts after a program, and or if there's a shift between the programs that the from which the material was appropriated, we have this insert indicating from which year, from which program, which format that these images were shot. And I also found it really interesting to give that clear indication where these images come from, which is not always the case in many documentary films, even with the archival form. But one scene that really struck me in that film was a program where two families living in Sweden, one from Palestinian family, the other Jewish family, watching the television from about what is going on at that zone, which is also shown on TV. So, which reminded me of Godard's Here and Elsewhere, which was also shot in the same period as this program, and how distance and television can impact our perception of things. So I really like that meta level that the footage itself added to the film, like how framing of the TV can impact certain things. And another thing I wanted to highlight was, as you mentioned, Sweden had this unbelievable resources, material and probably intellectual, a distance to go there and like do readings about the zone, because maybe when you're living in that reality, it's hard to get a grasp, like a full grasp of what is going on. So maybe that distance is sometimes detrimental, but also necessary. So there are like a pros and cons about that distance, but I think it's necessary. But there's also hierarchy of format of information, because they have these resources, as if like they have the property of images or of reality that these people are living in. So there is this disproportionate relationship with the reality depicted and reality lived. And I always find that interesting. I think Godard also has a small segment in Six Fois Deux, where about war photography and on these conflictual zones where people go, take images and come back. So I think Israel and Palestine also tackles with that aspect to war, like go there, take a representation or what is going on and coming back and claiming on our own, on a representational level. So I also found that really interesting in the film as well.
Okay, Lawrence, hit us with your number 9. Oh, did you already? Sorry.
Not yet. So my number 9 is...
Okay.
Mike Lee's Hard Truths, which feels like a bit more of a conventional pick. And I think if there is one film on my list that I am least sure of, it's this one. But I think, I mean, Mike Lee, I think at this point requires no introduction. And this is one of his very strong, dramatically driven character studies. And I think what I find affecting about his work and what I find effective about it is how he is able to make situations that would otherwise not be dramatic quite dramatic by virtue of just how strong the characterization is. So here you don't really have much more going on than a person going about their day, but precisely because of who this person is, it becomes like a kind of locus of all these sort of dramatic incidents. And it sort of builds toward a scene where the main character has basically a kind of lunch or a meal with her sister and her family. And just the ability to portray why this sort of just very normal meal, or what would be normal for an average person, is such like a Herculean effort for this woman is, I think, what sort of gets at, I don't know, what Mike Lee is about. I think I've started to value more his sort of ability to just create characters who have believable histories. And I think that's something that maybe in, especially in the more contemporary festival art cinema mode, is almost like undervalued. It's like, it's easy to discount how hard that can be to do. And I think he's one of the rare people who can do that seemingly effortlessly.
Great, I think. Has anyone else seen that? Because I have not, unfortunately. Yeah, so we all haven't seen that. We just have to take your word for it, Lawrence.
Well, you can let me know next year when you catch up with it.
Sure. And in the meantime,
Oiku.
My number nine is Les Reines du Drame, Queens of Drama by Alexis Langlois. I don't know if anybody has seen it here.
Nope.
No? So I have been following Alexis Langlois' work, I think, since 2021, while I was working for Mubi and doing subtitles for his shorts. And that was the period when I discovered. And this is his first, it's not his first feature. I'm not sure. Let me see. The Demons of... Yeah, I think it's his first feature. And I think... it hasn't been like circulated a lot in the I think Anglophone zone, but it's a queer musical about two stars. One of them are a pop star, the other is punk rock, and two, let's say, lesbian queer, because they have like a gender wise fluid identities, let's say, at least one of them. And how they were actually like friends and really close in the early 2000s, and then how their relationship like evolved and become like a feud in between, but it's still a love story. What I liked about it is how the year 2000s, that period, become a nostalgia, like a figure of nostalgia, and how that period is maybe, I haven't seen many examples of that are like taking that nostalgia seriously, really digging this pop culture, because it's also the period where the internet is making its entry to the like a more, it's becoming more widespread in the society, and how these pop culture started to circulate, and like figures like Britney Spears or Spice Girls, like of course we've been like joking, making funny videos about that, those figures, but I haven't seen many films that are, while being funny, taking that nostalgia, that period seriously and looking back to it. And it's also like, this is a year where people are praising Emilia Paris as a musical, while here we have this amazing piece of filmmaking with original songs and soundtracks also depicting queer identities. That's why I wanted to like highlight it and put it in my personal list so that people can discover. Like, as I said, like, this is not, my list is definitely not perfect, far from it, but I think I just wanted to like highlight this film as a statement, maybe, I'd say.
Okay. Eliana, do you want to hit us with your number eight then?
My number eight is Dahomey by Mati Diop. It won the Berlinale this year, I believe. It's an around 60-minute documentary slash docufic to fiction. It enters a territory that describes the returning of the 26 royal treasures from that were taken by the French from the original kingdom of Dahomey, which is in current-day Benin. And it documents the return of 26 out of how many, 50,000 or so. And this film was just very concise, very simple, and it engaged in all of the arguments that one might have with regard to colonialism, the acquiring of treasures, the looting, the modern day return, the idea of who gets what back, whether these objects are a part of the cultural identity of the people, of the modern day people who currently live in Benin, how they react to them, whether this is a political offering to make Macron look good, whether this is a political acceptance to make the then, I don't know if he's prime minister or president of Benin, look good as well. And it starts with a very simple way of embodying one specific statue, number 26, King Gezo statue, and it gives it a voice. And we watch as it's, through art logistic procedures, is placed gently into a bespoke crate and then shipped off to Benin. And the film is just so compact, and the fact that it lets one see very simply how and what is at stake and all the complicated facets to that appeals. I think it's a film that everyone can see. Of course, it doesn't necessarily resolve any of these things. A type of town hall, which takes a huge part in the third part of the film, goes on, and we hear people voicing all sorts of concerns regarding everything from the language that they're using to describe their outrage, primarily French instead of foam, to just how they receive these statues, whether as they were originally used for purposes of worship, but also to be feared to a degree, and to see them in a new museum setting, and to be, whether one should be in awe, whether one should even know how anymore to interact with the sculptures. And I thought it was just a very strong film.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that's a great choice. And I think I was especially taken with how smart this is, really. I think would of lesser filmmakers, maybe it would be so easy to just focus on the moral outrage, you know, and taking the audience emotionally. But Mati Diop, I think, is much above that and takes the audience seriously. And we can almost see, like, there are certain traps that the film might easily, you know, get into. But it's always one step ahead of us, you know, and one thinks, oh, now it's focusing just on the academic discourse or something. No, then the film goes to the street, you know, and talks to the people that are not part of the audience, and so on and so on. I think this shot when the camera is placed within the box and then it's opened, it's incredible. I think this film is so smart. It's so delicately composed and thought through that, yeah, I was really taken by it.
I had some questions about things that are not necessarily in the film, but as an audience, I think we have right to like ask or demand things that maybe the filmmaker didn't think of, but maybe should have. I don't know. But at least what I thought was that when this, the personality, like this, we have this character, maybe it's not a character, but the revenant that talks through the voiceover narration, and we kind of follow or listen him or they. I think it's accredited as them in the film. And what I wanted from Mati Diop was to also have her own engagement or her own place as a filmmaker in the making of the film, because I think since it's a film about excess, privilege, and being in places or institutions, I think her making the film also is a part of that hierarchical structure. And like, I wanted this level of self-awareness in the film, how the film itself deals with the hierarchies, because I read that this town hall sequence where students discuss was also initiated by the by Matediop requests. So it's not a, like a given reality, but a reality made because of the film. And I think that was a necessary acknowledgement that I would have liked to see in the film, or the pitfalls or the shortcomings of how the production or the film itself is also part of that discourse. And yeah, that was just my things I would have loved to see as well.
I mean, that's interesting to hear that the town hall was prompted by Matediop herself, that it wasn't just something that she came upon. That said, I do agree that the film is quite compact, very smartly made. I think a useful reference point to think about is Chris Marker's Statues Also Die. And I think, one of the questions that this film raises is, you know, with this booming voice of this like revenant god kind of character, is that they are returned to Benin after all these years, but is there still any longer a way of life that sort of supports this, right? Like one of the arguments that one of the young people makes is, oh, these are works of art, but I'm already to take them as works of art is to take them in quite a different way than they were originally used, right? And so it becomes a question, open question, whether this voice that we're hearing, I mean, still even like can be said to exist in a way, right? And I think that sort of stark disjunction between the kind of mythic quality of the voice and the documentary aspects of the town hall, I think was really quite effective.
Yeah, and I'm glad that you brought that up, Erku, because I did not know about that. I did find it a bit suspicious that when I listened to the Film Common podcast of the year overall, there was one audience question about, isn't that sort of problematic that this film was made by Matediop, you know, who has not the same origin of Bina and so on, who is to speak for whom and so on. And this was dismissed so easily as a question, and I sort of understand that because we want to see filmmaking as a universal project where this should be possible. But I think this acknowledgement that you're talking about, Erku, that is something that is perhaps not too much to ask for, especially if one considers what you said earlier about Israel-Palestine, the documentary, and how intricately it points us to the origin of the sources and the provenance. So yeah, definitely something that I think should be kept in mind. I will move on and introduce you to my number 8, which I will keep short and brief. This is Wang Bing's Youth Homecoming. You can think of it as the trilogy overall, I think, in my case, even though, yeah, I'm picking here Homecoming in particular, which premiered in Venice after the second film had played in Locarno a few months before. And yeah, I think this is an astonishing project overall that he pursued here. Wang Bing, whose work now, you know, if we think of how we store our knowledge about films, it's quite disturbing that the Chinese equivalent to Letterboxd, they have basically removed the entries of Wang Bing's filmography. So people, not only in China, they cannot see his films, they might not even know of, you know, their existence anymore, which is quite despicable. And I don't use that argument too often, but I was just very much emotional when seeing these films. I think he captures some truth, he captures some lived reality, and it just, you know, it's too much. You cannot, usually in the documentary, I always wonder, oh, these people actually know that there's a camera around all the time. This is just too long, you know, they cannot, the people there depicted, they cannot always be conscious of that camera. It's just his entire project is just too committed to the time he spent there for them to be always conscious of this camera. And you have just such moments of, yeah, you know, like as with the Jonas Mekas, you have like these small glimpses of beauty every now and then. Here in the third part, they move back to, you know, for Chinese Lunar Year, they move back to their hometowns. We see the conventions of marriages and weddings. You see what they do, for instance, the groom is carrying the bride from one village to the other. That's sort of a custom there. You have this train ride there where they are basically sleeping in the aisle because they, you know, they couldn't find a seat. And there's these small moments. We have very endearing voice messages where the one character sings and sends that to the other. And it's sort of their daily lived reality. So I should just say this is all placed in the situated in the Gamen districts where people basically are exploited on a daily basis in some more remote regions in China. A lot of them are actually migrant workers, so no one cares about their rights and their work contracts and so on. You see how they often come together to, you know, approach the boss for a raise in their salary and so on and so on. We have seen that before in the first two installments of the film. We have this return home and how they even try to just somehow grab the money to get the train ticket to return home. And it's all very endearing. It's all still, of course, committed to the overall project of displaying these atrocious daily lived reality there. And yeah, I would have kept watching this forever, knowing that my watching doesn't change anything in the slightest. So yeah, Wang Bing's Youth Homecoming for me. Any comments?
I only saw this third installment. I missed the first two, but I did. I mean, I found it quite affecting. And I think you're right to point out that there is something about Wang Bing's filmmaking where the duration of the camera makes the sort of the self-consciousness of the people in front of the camera matter a lot less. And I think that's integral to how the films work. I did feel like I was missing something a bit, having not seen the first two, because it does seem like a bit of a structural shift in that they go home in this section. So I would like to see it again, having first seen Youth Spring and Youth Hard Times.
Okay, and yeah, since we need to keep it short now, maybe, Lawrence, what is your number 8?
My number 8 is Hong Sang-soo's By the Stream, which will maybe come up again, or maybe not.
It's my number 8 as well.
Oh, okay.
Okay,
anyone
perfect.
Else?
Yeah, excellent. I mean, I've written at length about Hong Sang-soo before for a movie this year, and I think all
I recommend reading that.
Yeah, I think all I'll say about this film is that I think one of what I find interesting about Hong Sang-soo's recent films is how they sort of pare down their approaches. And so they're very minimalist, you know, very few camera movements, setups. And what that does is it makes you hyper attentive to the kind of repetitions that happen or don't happen. And what it does is that it's almost there's a kind of flatness to it that only in retrospect can you understand something as being important, precisely because of this kind of almost like flattening of the presentation that doesn't call attention to itself. You only notice the compositions or lines of dialogue as like being important only in retrospect. I think By the Stream is to me interesting because it almost goes in the opposite direction. Because every scene is almost filled with this sort of dramatic kind of incident, and that in a different way, it kind of achieves what this like late period, what I find interesting about this Hong late period is that because every interaction is almost so dramatically charged and so dramatically interesting, you actually don't even know then what is of dramatic importance from scene to scene. Like there will be important things that go on between the characters, but in the next scene, it may not even come up again at all. And so was it even of dramatic importance? And how do we understand that sort of convention? Yeah, that's all I'll say. Oiku, what did you think about By the Stream?
As I said, I think I was really like overwhelmed when I watched it. And I think our movie experiences are should be linked to the moment when we watched them, like how we were in that mindset. And when I watched it, I remember feeling like I was with a friend who unnecessarily oversharing things with me, like in a good way. I mean, so unexpectedly touching. And like, I know what to expect when I see a Hong film. But like, as you said, this dramatic outburst, like on a micro level, was so surprising. And they came up in moments that were so unexpected. And like things escalating on a micro level to like a really dramatic climaxes were really surprising for me. And I was at Locarno, it was really hot, I was really depressed and felt really lonely. And I felt that as if the film itself was like hugging me and said it was going to be okay, which was probably not related to film itself at all. But I think what I felt strong about this film was how it was able to channel emotions in the viewer. And I think many people who are into Hong would also feel the same. That being said, I don't think Hong Sang-soo this wasn't his intention at all. But I love how his filmmaking can become something different and how simple his intentions were or are, that it can be transformed and read on different levels. I like that idea of transmigration of his ideas, his vision. And I think that's what it counts the most, how a filmmaking that is so simple and minimal can transform and be read and received in so many different and personal levels. And I think it's so strong and so unique in a cinema. And I'm like all for his, like he can make 5 films a year, and I would still be there too, like with open-minded, open-hearted to watch them. And I think I like, especially, I think it's novelist film where there's a scene he films Kim Min-hae at the end of the film with a different color. I think it's black and white, or it's in color. Sorry, the film is black and white and it becomes like in color. And there's this interpersonal filmmaking moments between them. And I think By the Stream also features that kind of like intimacy on screen. Maybe they create in between themselves, or maybe I'm interpreting it that way, but I always kind of catch glimpses of this really intimate moments when she's in front of camera. And even though she is still in character, we can still see Kim Min-hae as Kim Min-hae herself, like kind of filtered through that character. And I also like that a lot.
Okay. Eliana, you already had your number 8, right? Okay, so we go to number 7, which for me is We Are Inside by Farah Kassem. I don't know if that appears on your list as well, Eliana?
It appears as my number 2, so I guess we'll talk about it later.
Move on. Lawrence, what is your number 7?
My number 7 is Kiyoshi Kurosawa's Chime, which premiered, I think, at the Berlinale earlier this year. And it's one of 3 films Kurosawa made this year, the other being Cloud, and which I did see at TIFF, and then Serpent's Path, which I still haven't seen. But Chime is, I think, less than an hour long. It's quite tight. And I found myself surprisingly taken with this, given that I have some sort of skepticism about Kurosawa. But I found this one really tightly made, in that there is a kind of like disturbance that occurs. There's like these strange violent occurrences. And what's interesting about the film is that there's a kind of over-determination about the source of these occurrences. Oh, you might think in one scene it's just the guy is disturbed. In another scene, it might be some sort of like ailment that's spreading throughout Tokyo, or maybe it's not actually Tokyo, the city that it takes place in. In another scene, it might be something else. Like, so the sort of the cause of these violent occurrences is sort of overdetermined. And in that way, it almost reminded me of Todd Haynes' Safe, in that sense, where potentially anything can become of importance as contributing to this like strange occurrence. And at the end of the film, there is this sort of shift to 16mm film that oddly in the context of this film has a really strange, uncanny kind of impact, because it's like almost the film itself becomes the cause of this like occurrence. And so I think the sort of the tightness of the conception and the execution is what I found really appealing about the film. Did anyone else see it?
That to me was... Yeah. I think that to me was the most interesting part of the film. I think this year was the year when I really had to solidify on the fact that this is not my filmmaker, you know. But I still think they always give you something to talk about. It's just that I don't enjoy his films very much, I think. Then, yeah. Eliana, what's your number 7?
Castration Movie Anthology Part 1, which appears later on your list.
Yes, so let's move to Oiku.
It's Misericorde for me, and I think it's already on, like, further in your list.
Yeah, it will show up later, I think.
The Perks of Overlap, we can go ahead and go to number 6, and I'm sorry to bring that up. I know you have discussed that already, but to me, you know, I only got to see it this year, is Los Delincuentes by Rodrigo Moreno. I love that film. I remember that day in Cannes when I asked Lawrence which of the 2 3-hour movies I should see, and he actually recommended this one, but I somehow got his message wrong, so I went into this other film I didn't appreciate so much. So, and this is the reason why I saw this film so late. Yeah, I love it. It now in hindsight, I can say it reminded me also of Pepe, which played at this year's Berlinale, in the sense that narrative is here, you know, it takes on the appearance of spontaneity. You think as if, we arrive at a scene and just by the interest the camera is taking in that scene, it might forget about its narrative, you know, and it goes into a different direction. And I think this is so fascinating. We already talked about that film, so if you want to hear more about it, you can listen to last year's episode. But I really like this idea of how narrative can seemingly transform as it evolves before our eyes. And yeah, I think this is a film I will revisit many times in my lifetime, just because it's so pleasurable as well. It's fun. It is dreamlike. You know, like, it has this oneric quality, and it's seemingly spontaneous, and that's why what I love about it. So yeah, Los Delincuentes by Rodrigo Moreno, and of course, upholding the Argentinian flag. I think there are so many great directors these days. So yeah, Lawrence, what is your number 6?
My number 6 is Jonas Treba's The Other Way Around, which...
That is going to show up.
Which will show up, so we can move on for now.
Okay, your number 6.
My number 6 is Sami Millar. You guys have it?
No. Eliana? No. Okay.
No.
Yep.
No? Oh, okay. So this is also, this is the second Locarno film I think I'm mentioning today. This is also made by a French filmmaker, Virgil Vernier. This is his third feature film. And it's actually like a good Christmas film, by the way, if you guys want to like note it down. And I think the way I engaged with this film was also quite related to the atmosphere, the setting that I was watching it. It's also a film that really touched us collectively, because I was part of the Letterboxd jury, and with the fellow jurors, this was like the film that kind of bonded us, that helped us bond us over this really hard and harsh environment in Locarno. But if I go back to Virgil Vernier, I think he has a really distinctive filmmaking style in French context. He always, in his previous features and shorts, he seeks these non-spaces of late capitalism, or at least cities like Geneva, Sofia Antipolis, or countries like Andorra, where this richness, opulence, and excess is framed in a way that it diffuses beauty in a really uncanny way. Like you feel like you don't need to appreciate the beauty of this empty richness, but his 16mm photography is so strong that it creates this uncanny bling bling feeling that you kind of get mesmerized by its quality. And in Sami Millar, we follow this 18-year-old sex worker, Affine, who lives in Monaco, and it's the Christmas time, it's the holiday, so he has nothing to do because all his other fellow sex worker friends go go have plans. And so he has a, I don't know if they met, if they met before, like prior to the, what goes on in the story, but this lithotherapist friend from, I think she was from Serbia or maybe Croatia, I'm not sure, who takes care of a young girl who has rich parents working in construction, and they celebrate Christmas together. Each of these three characters have their own loneliness that I don't think we get to like touch their loneliness, but I think we still sense, or like we see they're lonely, but I don't think Vernier totally opens up their characters to us. But we share at least a common loneliness while watching the film. And there are some elements that are strongly connected both on a visual and on symbolic level to fairy tales. And I think the film, in a way, asks questions if the fairy tales are still possible in our hypermodern, late capitalist society. If connections, if being together, sharing space is enough to feel connected to someone, or can we still connect to someone? And these questions, I think, really touched me. And he has this elements of weird symbolic or spiritual things in the film that can be seen quite quirky, kitschy. But I think like having beliefs, having the ideas like mirror hours, like 2222, and like thinking of, is there an angel that is like trying to send me a message? This kind of spiritual thinking is something we're lacking today in a rationalized way of thinking. Even though it's quirky, it's weird, I know, but like having space to those weird things, this minor spiritual ideas, I cherished it a lot. And I think it's also like a really personal choice, but I know that Patrick and Eliana also enjoyed it a great deal. So maybe they want to jump in and say what they thought of it as well.
Yeah, I thought it was just a very beautiful film, both aesthetically and also in its meandering sense of the following of the protagonist. He has this unearth-like quality as he wanders and as he doesn't seem to really desire, but yet he's put into these moments in which you feel, you get the sense of yearning, and somehow this idea of what it might mean to live in Monaco, where the Christmas lights are decking the porches and the three-story buildings, personal buildings of some people, and became weirdly desirable, even though paradoxically so too, because this is also where all of this malaise might also be coming from. And I found the little fairy tale aspect and elements also just endearing from the little girl's point of view, who seems to be living in this ultra privilege, ultra, when you can't see anything, or when you're very protected.
Oh, okay.
But protected more existence, okay. Where she believes this absurd thing because she's been told that there will be the end of the world coming, but she will be saved because her parents will be building an island. But there's something still very dear about this small hope that she sees even in these completely absurd and ridiculous and unrelatable circumstances.
Okay, great. Yeah, I have other things to say, but we have to move on. So I will continue with my number five, The Other Way Around by Jonas Trüber. Does that appear anywhere else, or can we talk about it?
Are we on five?
Well, it's my number six.
Are we not?
But yeah, I think we're on number five now.
Are we not?
Did we skip six?
I didn't think we did, but maybe your number six is still missing, Eliana, then.
My number six is Bluish / Only Imagine Us Light.
Yes.
But
I have Bluish, I think, at four. So maybe
we'll make it Bluish.
Okay.
We'll talk about it later.
Okay, good. So we then move on to number five, which is The Other Way Around by Jonas Trüber, filmmaker from Madrid. I think he reminds me a bit of, you know, like the cinematic equivalent to Javier Marías, in that it's very tongue-in-cheek. It's like with Marías, the writer, you have very long, intricate sentences. Here you have intricate, long thought experiments that, assume a very mundane, prosaic quality, but are still, you know, very thought-provoking. Here it's a bit of, can think of it as the premise that you might find in earlier comedies of Hollywood. The premise is that there's this central couple, and the father of the woman always said, instead of celebrating marriage and wedding, we should actually celebrate the separation or divorce. And this becomes here sort of the narrative, because the central couple, we don't really know why, but they seem to be bound to divorce. And we don't know anything about the origin of that thought. But as they go on with that idea that they should separate, they think, oh, we should pay tribute to the father here. And they should exactly do that. They should have a celebration about that, invite all the friends. And the film goes on and on. They meet all their friends and family members, and they tell the story again, how they are going to separate and they want to throw a party about it. And you see how this narrative shifts and evolves, becomes more and more like a narrative, as with a screenplay one might imagine, you know, when you have a first script version, a second version, and so on. And as they become more and more conscious of their storytelling, they feel more and more trapped in their own narrative. And I find this is so fascinating. It's so simple on the one hand, but it's so complex if you think about the implications of this. And yeah, there are a lot of literary and cinematic references to Ingmar Bergman and Liv Ullmann, for instance, where they liken the relationship of this central couple to them. And you have the Kierkegaardian motif of repetition. And of course, the repetition here takes its central core of the film. And I just have been really infatuated in recent years with the notion of repetition. And I think this film does a stellar job in depicting that. So yeah, Jonas Trüber's The Other Way Around, Lawrence, that also appeared on your list.
Yeah, so it was my number six. I think you covered a lot. I think what I find most appealing about this film is there's a kind of reflexive element to it. So the wife, she's a filmmaker, and the husband is an actor. And so there's a reflexive quality to the film where it seems like the film we're watching is the film that they're almost making, almost in progress. And while I initially kind of was resistant to this move, I was like, oh no, another film about them making another film with like a kind of meta quality. I actually found it appealing that the film is really not so much about the artistic process, I think, but more about, or what I liked at least, is that it doesn't allow, it's not to me as interesting in terms of its reflections on the artistic process. But what I find most appealing was that how this sort of framing device kind of allowed for the film to sort of mix the kind of Hollywood screwball energy with the kind of like almost Eric Rohmer, like naturalism of, and I think the sort of the framing device allows for that kind of an interesting mix. One of the big reference points is, I think, the Hollywood comedies of remarriage that Stanley Cavell wrote about, and that is brought up in the book. And I think that sort of remarriage element is here, but in a way that like manages to sort of ask, like, what would it be like to make a remarriage comedy, you know, after Eric Rohmer, as it were. And I think that's kind of what I find appealing about the film. But yeah, Jonas Trüber, I think quite an underrated filmmaker in some ways. Like, this film was in the fortnight, but I don't know if it went anywhere after that. But I find all of his films that I've seen at least quite good. Like,
Stopping Us, right? This very long docu-fiction from a few years ago was also quite strong.
Yeah.
And what I liked, just as like a short thing to add, is that I think he has his own like cinematic imagery and landscapes. And if you, like, once you get into his cinema, maybe it's like a, for people who already watched his previous films, but like it's some, like, Stanley Cavell also comes up in August Virgin. So I think this like highlights and references And Vink said his previous films is also nice to catch. And I like that how he builds this coherent, not coherent, but his Madrid, you know, the bridge. I think the character from August Virgin was supposed to jump is also comes up in that film. So that they have this like intertextual references in between his films. And I think it also kind of, maybe not as like, maybe in Romare it's less, but I think the way his films like are connected to each other appeals me a lot. It's like a thing I can't resist not liking. And yeah.
Okay. Eliana, what's your number five?
My number five is Tu Me Abrazas, You Burn Me.
That will appear on my list.
So we'll talk about that later.
Yes. Okay. And Erku?
I have Eat the Night by Caroline Poggi and Jonathan Vinel. Anyone? Another French filmmaker duo. I have a lot of French cinema this year, I guess. So Eat the Night is a film about a brother and a sister who's been obsessing over this video game that will be shut down in a given time. And the brother, the older brother, is also, like, maybe to give a context, I think Caroline Poggi and Jonathan Vinel have been making films like a kind of touching to the video games, and like their filmic universes are always always featuring at least this kind of video game quality in their cinema, not directly, but always depicting people or influenced by how video games can become in characters. Like, I have to say, like, this idea of characters that have missions to accomplish without having anything other to do, like how video games can impact our construction of characters. I'd say I'm kind of lost my train of thought, but here they're using video game imagery embedded in the film, and they created this video game specifically for the film, and I really liked how the impending end is depicted in the film, because we know that this game will be, the server will be shut down, and the countdown, the coming to an end, walking towards the inevitable, this idea is, I enjoyed it a lot, and how it was also embedded in the story, because like the story itself is it's not cliche, but I think this is a story we've seen it many times, but I think this inevitability in the story and how the game itself will be shut down is also part of the story and how it was told. And like these stereotypes in French cinema about drug dealings, about gangs, are also used for their own purposes. Like I think there was a self-awareness of the tropes they were using in the film, and I also liked it a lot. And I think they are part of a generation who grew up with video games, playing video games, and I think they were quite aware of how this habit of theirs or the affected their worldview, and they were trying to appeal or try to depict a generation who also grew up with video games, and their habits can impact their real lives. Like even the game stops in the computer, since their way of thinking, their being in the world is impacted by the game itself. How our psyches, how our as persons function after being influenced in that culture, after growing up in that culture. I like that these ideas. It's a bit of a mess the way I present the film, but yeah.
But I think the way you intertwine video game and the narrative of the film is very productive, and I think this is certainly one of the more compelling ways of viewing that film, and I think makes it more, you know, intelligible to the viewer. I think we have to change our structure here a bit, because Lawrence cannot stay with us so long. So I think, even though it's a bit, you know, anticlimactic maybe, Lawrence, I think we run through your remaining list first, because then you can leave, you know, and we can go on with our list, but I think that's the only way we can incorporate all of your films here.
Okay, sure.
Thank you for joining us for part one of our top 10 films of the year 2024. You can check out our show notes if you'd like to connect with any of us. And part two shall follow soon.